My wife hates it when I scare her. So I do so regularly to keep her blood pressure from getting too low. Did you know there's all these channels on YouTube that are devoted to video clips of people getting really scared just by somebody jumping around the corner? I don't know what it is. I love those channels. I'll sit there and watch them for, 20, 30 minutes. Just nothing but people getting scared. But I've noticed some things. Some people curse. Some people call for Jesus. Some people laugh hysterically after they've been frightened. And some people get really mad. She actually threw food at me the other day after I scared her. Most of us, except the really crazy ones, don't really like to be afraid. I'm not talking about somebody saying boo. I'm not talking about going to a scary movie or even one of these haunted houses. There's an adrenaline rush to those things, I understand. But I'm talking about being afraid. Sadly, our culture is not only able to smell fear, it's come to prey and trade upon fear. The reason for that is simple. If you think about it, and I hope that you will, fear motivates us. As human beings, fear is one of our primary motivations. Fear causes us to move, or it paralyzes us. And if the fear-inducing agent can be accurately aimed, it either moves us in the direction that they desire, or it paralyzes and prevents us from moving at all. Again, as they desire. But this lesson today is not about the cultural means and methods of manipulation of a society through fear. But I think there are spiritual applications and perspectives that we need to think about. Spiritually speaking, we need to know not only what we're most afraid of, but more importantly, how our God calms those fears. After all, when did "don't be afraid" actually work? Unless there were some good reasons provided not to be afraid. One of the things that troubles me about our society is how fearful we have become. We're afraid of a lot of things. And I think that is motivating us to either move in some cases in wrong directions or to be unable to move at all. So of what are you typically afraid? I'm not talking about statues or things that are culturally fear-inducing to snowflakes. I'm talking about us. Of what are we typically afraid? We're going to talk about 5 D's. Not spiders or snakes or lizards, but 5 things that have spiritual implications attached to them. The first one, and we have to begin here, is death. I suppose it's somewhat natural since life is all that we know and experience. We've never been dead before. So there's some fear of the unknown attached to that, and as such, trepidation associated with it. Then sometimes we know from having seen it, death is accompanied by a lot of pain and suffering. And there is a very natural fear associated with all of those. Even Jesus himself in Matthew 26 and in verse 39 prayed earnestly to the Father, "Let this cup pass from me. If there's another way for this to be accomplished, this be the salvation of mankind, other than my suffering and dying this excruciatingly painful death, can we please do that?" So there is a natural fear of death and the things that are associated with it that I get, we understand. But some are abnormally afraid of death who ought not to be. When I say abnormally, I mean because of the spiritual position we occupy. There is an excessive fear of death that ought not to exist. The fact that everyone dies, and we know this, doesn't help our fear of death. What does help is revealed knowledge on the subject from one who has died and has lived again. That Jesus revealed to us some things through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, through the inspired apostles and writers of the New Testament, that ought to change our perspective of death. There's always going to be some trepidation, but we as God's children, knowing what we know, should not fear death the way that the world does. Because after all, from the world's perspective, this life is all there is. And the end, therefore, of this life is a thing of great tragedy, something to be avoided at all cost, and certainly something to be feared. But it ought to be different for us. And here's why. Look in 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, in verse 36. 1 Corinthians 15 and 36, Paul is talking to the Corinthians, and there's a specific problem there in Corinth that he is addressing, wherein some say that there is no resurrection of the dead. And so he's gone into great lengths to expose this error by talking about the fact that Christ died and rose again, or was resurrected. In verse 36, he said, You fool, that which you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And that which you sow, you do not sow the body which is to be, but the bare grain, except of wheat or of something else. Now stop right there for just a moment and understand that our body is being compared to a seed of bare grain. You don't like that comparison? That's the analogy. That the full bloom, the mature plant, is only going to come after what happens. After this seed is planted in the earth. Because it dies. Now, we want the full plant. We want the flowers. We want the shade. We want the glory of the full being. But what we have to understand is this life, this body, is just the seed, the bare grain, that only produces that full bloom of God's intention after we die. Now to me, I don't know about you, but to me that's a beautiful thought. An encouraging one that helps me to look at my impending death. And impending death is impending for all of us. With less fear and more expectation. That God has so arranged and prepared and created things that after this bare grain has died and is planted in the earth, the full effect is manifested in heaven, in the afterlife. The text here goes on, and I urge you to read it. But if that doesn't help us to have a different perspective of death, I'm not sure that I can. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verses 14 and 15, it plainly says that Jesus died in order to deliver us from the fear of death. Think about it. Are you afraid to die? And if so, why? Is it because you are unprepared for your life to end? That you know that when your seed, your bare grain is planted in the earth, it's not going to rise and bloom to God's full intended glory. But it's going to be burned up. If that's the case for you, then you ought to be afraid of death. But if it's not the case for you, you've been delivered from the fear of death by the power of Jesus Christ. Number two, the second D that we're often afraid of is darkness. Why do we fear the dark? Because there's things out there that can kill you in the dark, right? Well, yes, there are. So it's not an irrational fear necessarily to be afraid of the dark, because there are things that may be there that we cannot see. But we need to remember again, death, if we're prepared for it, if we're ready to bloom in the next life, then we shouldn't be, as Jesus said and told His disciples in Matthew 10 and verse 28, not to fear those who can kill the body. We don't have to be afraid of the dark if we're not afraid of dying. What else is going to happen to us? But more directly, and more specifically, look with me at John 8 and verse 12 for just a moment. Again, John 8, verse 12. Again, therefore, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light. Think about it. The light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. Now, aside from there being difficulty in sleeping, I can sleep with the light on, it doesn't bother me, but some people can. Imagine that everywhere you went in life was illumined because you were there. You're glowing. Remember when Moses went up on the mountain and got the law? Went up on Mount Sinai, got the law, he came down, and because he had been in the presence of God, his face shone so brightly that he had to put a veil over his face so the Israelites could look at it. Imagine you're like that for just a moment. Everywhere you go in life, regardless of how dark it is, you're illumined. You are light. Now, Jesus said, I am the light of the world. That's a big light. To light up the whole world. But when we are right with God, that light is in us and with us. Look at the verse again, verse 12. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness because he's light, but also because you shall have the light of life. Do you ever feel like you're in the darkness of life? That you're just stumbling and banging your pinky toes on everything that life has to offer? There's a reason for that. There's light lacking. I think I've told you before, years ago when we lived in Jacksonville, I got up in the middle of the night from a dead sleep one night. I was trying to get from our bed, which required me to get up, go that way, turn that way, and then turn that way to the bathroom. And one of those left turns turned into a right, and I got into our closet, which had bifold doors. Donna had to get up and get out of bed and come help me out of the closet because I was just going all around in that closet. Do you know why? Yes, I was dead asleep. There wasn't a single light on anywhere in that room. It was even a dark night outside, so there was no external light coming. There was not a single point of reference, let alone point of illumination. Now, when we don't have that point of reference or that illumination, we're going to have some really gnarly pinky toes in life. Our knees are always going to be skinned. But spiritually speaking, when we have not only that light of Jesus to illumine us, when we have Jesus within us to the degree that we produce light ourselves, what did he say in Matthew 5? You are the light of the world. Then everywhere that we go, are not only we, it's not only illuminated for us, but for those who are around us. You don't have to be scared of the dark. When you have the light of Jesus Christ within you, things get clearer, less dark. You can see not only the obstacles and the dangers and the pitfalls that are otherwise in the darkness and avoid them, but you know where to go. You don't wind up banging around in the closet. In Luke, the 11th chapter, verse 36, final passage on this point. Luke 11, verse 36. If therefore your whole body is full of light, with no dark part in it, it shall be wholly illumined as when the lamp illumines you with its ray. What a beautiful concept for those who are otherwise afraid of the dark. Number three, we're not only afraid of death and darkness, we're afraid of being different. We generally don't like feeling different than everyone else. Sometimes we even fear it to the degree that it causes us to rush along with the herd, even if they're running over the cliff. But here's the question. Even for those who fear being different, different from whom? If you're afraid of being different, of being singled out, who is it that you're afraid of being different from? And I know you're not supposed to end sentences in prepositions, and I usually don't, but that's the easiest way to express the thought. You see, the real problem is not that we're afraid of being different. And bear with me a second. It's that we're afraid of being different from the wrong people. We're afraid as Christians of being different from the world. When what we should be afraid of is being different from others who are Christians. So take that the next logical step. If we're afraid of being different from the world, we're hanging out with the wrong people. Because if we come back over here, we're like everybody else who fears God more than they fear the opinions of people. That makes sense to you? I know that's somewhat oversimplified, perhaps, But I think, and I really believe, that we're simply afraid of being different from the wrong group of people. After all, do we really want to be like a world? And I know this is easy, but it illustrates the point. Who can't tell male from female? Who is sad that they may not be able to kill babies in the womb anymore? Who doesn't understand basic biology and sexual reproduction? Is that who we really want to be like? Are we afraid of being different from that? No, we need to be over here in this group and afraid to be different from them and like the world. In John the 15th chapter. Where'd John go? It's right here between Luke and Acts somewhere. John 15. Look at the text there in verse 19. Excuse me. I want to back up to John. No, we'll just go to John 15, 19. That works too. I had another passage too. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I choose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. We need to stop being afraid of being different or perceived as different by the world. We need to be afraid of being different than Jesus and those who are His. And as simplistic as this sounds, if we're afraid of being different from or perceived as different from the world, we're in the wrong group and concerned about the wrong thing. Go back over here and spend your time with those who are like you, like Christ, and trying to be imitators of Christ. Then how you dress is going to be pretty much how they dress. The things that you like are going to be pretty much the things that they like. And it's not going to be that way over there, and it never will be, unless you are part of that group. Now look in 1 John 5. In 1 John 5, in verse 19. And we know that we are of God, and the whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Aside from the points that we've already made, understand there's only two groups. We need to be very careful which one we're afraid of being different from or viewed as different from. Fourthly, the older I get, the harder it is for Donna to get me out of the house to go and do things. I've become a homebody. I don't think it was COVID. That probably helped, but I think I was already headed that way. And at the risk of sounding arrogant, I enjoy my own company. I don't mind being alone, relatively speaking. Because when I'm apart from that woman back there for about 3 days, that's long enough. But one of the things that has happened during all the COVID and lockdown and stuff is people have become much more isolated. And some people have adapted to that and have decided they're just not people persons. I'm not a people person, they say. Well, it's not that in every case, at least for me. And while there are some people that don't really mind being alone, no one likes to be deserted. Fourth D. We're afraid of being deserted. The idea of being abandoned terrifies us. Especially when we already feel that when we're already afraid of being different, in the dark, and dying. Now, we'll put all of those together for just a moment and imagine that you're different, that it's dark, and that you're dying, and there's no one there. Whoever you depended upon in life to be with you through life and to the end of your life has abandoned you. And now you're facing your differences in the dark, dying, and you're deserted. Creating a nightmare for you yet? That's not my intention. I'm just understanding or trying to understand myself the things that we are most afraid of and how God, and specifically Christ, meets every one of those fears. What did He say to His disciples in John 14? I will never leave you. I am with you always. I will never desert you. Troubles and difficulties, even trials and temptations, are easier to bear when we're not alone. When we haven't been abandoned or deserted to our difficulties. Even Jesus sent out His disciples in pairs. He sent them out in twos, Mark 6 and verse 7. And in life, there may be a lot of people that have deserted or abandoned you. Spouses may abandon you. Friends may forsake you. Co-workers may isolate or scapegoat or backstab or even gaslight you. But Jesus and those who are truly His will never desert you. At the risk of getting too personal here, look in Romans 8 and verse 15. I'm going to try to be careful with this. In Romans 8 and verse 15, it says, "For you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons by which we cry out, Abba, Father." Think about the child that has been abandoned by those who ought to protect and care for it. Abandoned. Orphaned. By those who ought to be there to provide all of those things that children need. What a hopeless, helpless feeling that must be. Now, what does Jesus say through Paul to the Romans? You have received a spirit of adoption. To one who was in that other situation, what kind of elation and hope and inexpressible joy has to come with that word adoption? As much as we feel like people in our lives have abandoned or deserted us, and you may be exactly right about that. Whether it's family, friends, employers, whoever has abandoned and deserted you and left you feeling that helpless, understand what Jesus is saying here. I will never abandon or desert you because I have adopted you. Now, how do you get to that? Well, Galatians 3, verses 26, 7, 8, and 9 talk about us becoming sons of God by faith through baptism. There's an adoption process. It doesn't happen against our will or without our participation. But once we have that process handled, He says, I won't ever desert you. I won't ever leave you. You will always be mine. Look in Hebrews, the 13th chapter, and verse 5. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Let your way of life be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For He Himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. As much as people have let you down in your life, regardless of who or where you came from, God has never once let anyone down. He's not going to start with you. You don't have to fear being deserted in Christ. You don't have to fear being left alone to face whatever else it is that comes along your way in life. He will always be there for you. And number 5, we fear disappointment. We fear our own failures. We feel that others are going to fail us. We are afraid we're going to disappoint someone else, or we're afraid someone else is going to disappoint us. Life in general is filled with failures and disappointments. Maybe that's why I like baseball. You can fail in baseball 3 out of 10 times and be a great hitter. Our families may disappoint us. In fact, that's pretty much guaranteed by Matthew 10, verses 34 and 35, where He talks about a man's enemies will be those of his own household. He came not to bring peace, but to set a father against a son and a mother against a daughter. A man's enemies will be those of his own household. Those disappointments are going to happen. Friends may fail us. In Matthew 26, in the latter part of verse 56, all of Jesus' disciples fled when He was arrested. They had said previously, let's go and we'll die with you. Peter said, never shall this happen to you, Lord. I won't let it, basically, is the idea. But when it came right down to it, those men who had spent 3.5 years with Him, virtually 24/7, fled. Your family may disappoint you. Your friends may fail you. Your employers or jobs or co-workers are likely to, at some point, at least frustrate or even dishearten you. But listen closely now. The Lord has never disappointed, failed, or let down anyone who trusted in Him. And He never will. You still open to Hebrews 13? We read verse 5. But there's a comma at the end of that, where He has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you, so that we confidently say, verse 6, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What shall man do to me? Whether it's a spouse, whether it's a friend, whether it's an employer, an employee, it doesn't matter who else it is. Jesus is never going to disappoint you if you trust in Him. He never will. Do me a favor. I'm not going to take time to do it. Go read Romans, the 8th chapter. Go read Romans chapter 8. And especially start in verse 18 and read down through the end of that chapter this afternoon. I promise you, you will be encouraged by doing so. Okay, I want to leave you with 2 points and we're done. In conclusion, Satan wants you to be afraid. He will use any power at his disposal to make you fearful, which is full of fear. Because when we are scared, we're easier to manipulate to his purposes. He can either get us to move in the way he wants us to go, or to paralyze us in such fear that we can't go in the ways that we need to go. Satan wants you to be afraid. Jesus wants you to be calm. He said to his disciples in John 14 and verse 27, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I leave with you. Not like peace like the world, but my peace." He wants you to be at peace. That's the opposite of being afraid. He wants you to be confident. Look in Hebrews, the 4th chapter, and in verse 16. Hebrews 4, verse 16 says this, "Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace." Why do we have confidence? Because that throne on which Christ sits is one of grace. He wants us to be confident, not fearful and cowering. He wants us to be calm. He wants us to be confident. And he wants us to be courageous. We just sang about that a few moments ago. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Listen to it as I read for you from 2 Corinthians 5 verses 7 and 8. We'll get verse 6 to get the start of the sentence. "Therefore, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight, we are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body to be at home with the Lord." Satan wants you to be afraid. Jesus wants you to be calm, he wants you to be confident, and he wants you to be courageous. With whom are you going to cast your lot? Is it over here or is it over here? With and in Christ, you don't have to be afraid. You don't have to cower. You don't have to always be biting your nails and wringing your hands. It doesn't have to be that way. There's a different life awaiting you in Christ. 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7, "For God has not given us a spirit of timidity or fear, but of power and love and discipline." You get to pick. The choice is yours now. Will you commit your life to Christ and stop living in fear of death, of darkness, of being different, of being disappointed? That's the life Satan wants for you. It's not the life Jesus has prepared for you. We can help you. You come while we stand, while we sing.